Thank you so much, Aya Tatarluka, for joining us today. Everyone at the BSWA community sends their regards and their good wishes. And today I'd like to ask you a few questions that have come from our fourfold Sangha, and it really has been a fourfold Sangha effort. So we have questions from the nuns and from the monks and from the householder men and women. And you are very special to us, Aya Tatarluka, because we all know that you were the preceptor for our nuns back in 2009 up at Dharmasara. And reading through your backstory here, my goodness, very impressive stuff. So I know that you were the first Western woman to be appointed as a Theravadin Bhikkhuni preceptor. You've also presented to the Dalai Lama. And you've undertaken extensive research in comparative Bhikkhuni Vinaya. And I really appreciated the interview that you recently did with Sol Hanna on Treasure Mountain. And some of my friends and I were saying that, wow, this is the first time we really appreciated the struggle that our sisters have been through to be able to obtain full ordination. So we can jump straight into the questions, or maybe I would like to invite you just to say a few words and, give a bit of a hello shout out to our community here in Western Australia.
So, hello and shout out to the community in Western Australia. I'm Aya Tatarluka, and I'm coming to you from our Aranyabodhi Awakening Forest Hermitage on the Sonoma coast of Northern California. This is not an artificial screensaver kind of backdrop here. This is our real the real thing here in our forest. And I'd just like to Yeah, my greetings to Sandra and to everyone with the BSWA, all old friends and new friends, and also to Ajahn Brahm, Lungpur Brahm, and to the whole Venerable Bhikkhu Sangha and Bhikkhuni Sangha, Ubhato Sangha, and the whole fourfold community, or I like to say manifold community, actually, because fourfold is based on a binary. And I think the meaning is to be inclusive rather than to be exclusive. So, to be inclusive in our contemporary times, I feel like if we say fourfold, it's also good to say the manifold community. And so, this full moon, September 9th, September 10th, this year, 2022, then is thought to be the 2606th anniversary of the founding of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, and with that, the fulfillment of the Buddha's intention to have a community of really well-practiced, well-realized, capable bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas. And of that intention from the time of the Buddha's awakening, even before he set the Dhamma wheel in motion, turning the Dhamma wheel in the deer park in Sarnath, in the Garden of the Seers, he had this intention, founding intention and dedication to have such a community of disciples and heirs. And so this full moon, at least as passed down in the Sri Lankan traditions, this is the lunar anniversary. And also for the past 12 years, one full cycle of the zodiac, then this has been celebrated as International Bhikkhuni Day. So it's the 12th International Bhikkhuni Day, and per classical Theravada counting, the scholars may debate the exact years, it's the 2606th anniversary of the founding of our Bhikkhuni Sangha. So we're celebrating that, and we're celebrating it all the more so. People stopped celebrating it because there wasn't a four-fold community in Theravada Buddhism, and there wasn't a Bhikkhuni Sangha. So, you know, it's just remembered as something historical, but now it becomes a living celebration once again. And you said some really kind and appreciative words about my role as the Bhikkhuni preceptor for the first dual Theravada Bhikkhuni ordination in Australia. It was actually at Bodhinyana for the first four Bhikkhunis from Dhammasara Monastery, now the Bhikkhuni Monastery of the BSWA, the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, with Bodhinyana being the Bhikkhu Monastery. So that's where I was first appointed as a Bhikkhuni preceptor. Pavatini Upajaya was there in Australia with the community of the BSWA. So that was a very special and moving and momentous time in my life and for many others as well. And so I remember that with appreciation. I think now that was back in 2009, so that's been a few years ago now, already more than 12 years ago.
Yeah.
So, wow, what an awesome thing. International Bhikkhuni Day must have been launched like the year after that then. It seems like probably because of that. So the next year then we came back here, and then I served as a Bhikkhuni preceptor for the first time in North America, which is where I was born. I might have been conceived down under, but born here in USA and North America. And so we had the first then Theravada Bhikkhuni ordinations with the dual Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Sangha here at our Aranyabodhi Hermitage, just a few feet away from where we are now then in 2010, just the following year. And it's been... That was the year that International Bhikkhuni Day started. I'm actually here with the former president of the Alliance for Bhikkhunis, who were part of starting this observance and the celebration, and she is a seminary now and helped with setting up today. So we want to appreciate her lots and lots, to appreciate everyone who has been involved, because as the Buddha said in his salient teaching on conditional causation, it's not just one cause, it's always this group of supporting causes that really gives rise to virtue, gives rise to liberation, and the cessation of other causes, which then also, you know, lead the hindrances to fall away and to cease, and the path to open up. So much appreciation. And with these words of greetings to everyone, then let's go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you for that beautiful introduction. And I think that is a wonderful way of leading into our very first question. And the question on everyone's lips is, do men and women practice differently? And how important is the form of Bhikkhuni? Because we know at the heart of it, the teachings are essentially genderless in many regards. I mean, pronouns are used, but essentially, they are quite genderless. And we need to admit that when it comes down to it, as Ajahn Brahm says, there are things that women go through that men will never understand. And the Bhikkhuni Sangha, in providing a spiritual service to the community, provides a different perspective and angle, which we feel is very much needed. So whether it is allowing women supporters to fully receive blessings and merits, or having a feminine presence to offer compassion and kindness in our time of need. My sisters and I, we all agree that there is a warmth and an emotional roundness to being in the company of caring women. And I wondered if you'd like to say a little bit about that, the form of the bhikkhuni, the notion of gender, and do we practice differently?
Well, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. It seems to me in some ways gender absolutely doesn't matter. And certainly this is highlighted in so many ways in the Buddhist teaching. And in other ways, gender absolutely does matter to most people. It's like both part of form and then also part of our people's sense of themselves, of which form is an important part. But of course, it's not only about form. And the Buddhist teaching also certainly recognizes this, that is all, you know, all that's there in terms of eye-making related to form, feelings, perceptions, karmic formations, consciousness, all of this. And I think especially in those mental formations of self, this is the place where gender is so much constructed. And I think constructed uniquely for each one of us, even in each moment, because it's absolutely a moving target. It's not something that's fixed. It doesn't just start out one way when you're born or when you're in the womb and then just stay like that for your whole life. Just like our bodies are continuously changing and our feelings are continuously changing, then our perceptions are continuously changing as well. Our ideas, our concepts, all of that. And I think in this realm, then, you know, seeing others who look like us or whom we identify with doing something that we have aspiration for, even if it's latent aspiration, even if it's underlying, that's like one way we might not have even known that it was there in our constitution in a way until we see somebody and something, and that starts to activate that for us. And, you know, admiration, inspiration, and having luminary leaders, I'd say having ethical leaders and exemplars who embody moral virtue, and having exemplars who are meditators, having exemplars who have wisdom, and in terms of our sangha, then having those who we identify with and feel a sense of affinity with among the teachers and the leaders, as well as the Dhamma friends and the practitioners in our communities, in the Sangha, is enormously important. And in terms of the refuge of the Sangha, then the Buddha himself pointed out in a way that even seems kind of proud in one of the suttas, that he has the awakened disciples of hundreds of awakened disciples, fully awakened disciples who are bhikkhus, hundreds of fully awakened disciples who are bhikkhunis, and also those who have entered the Arahant path and are noble ones who are upasakas and upasikas amongst his disciples in no small numbers. And it seems like this is something that the Buddha is making a very clear point about, that this is part of the, in a way, part of the pride of Buddhism. And it's what the Buddha himself intended. And then for this to be appearing in the world is part of what the Buddha wished to offer in teaching and establishing a sangha. So seems again absolutely genderless, deep Dhamma, deep and effective Dhamma in one way, and to be able to see others like us and for the path to be open for those like us, very, very important in what the Buddha intended to offer for us. You know, some people say that having bhikkhunis is really only important for lay women, Because the bhikkhunis are like able to uniquely empathize with the sufferings and struggles and dreams and hopes and aspirations of women. I just want to state very clearly that from what I see, that may be true. I don't deny that at all. It's really important. And also, I really see that what the bhikkhunis, the living bhikkhunis, and now as we have, bhikkhunis at all stages up to Mahateris again, it's actually, I think, really important for everybody in terms of, I don't even know how to put it in words, but it's not just important for women. Just say that. It's important for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree, it is very important for all genders. Now, it's been a long time coming, the reformation of the Bhikkhuni Sangha. And I guess for some of us in the West, we see our nuns being ordained. We read beautiful stories about Western nuns being ordained. And then we watch documentaries like the recent one where Thai ladies are really still struggling to be able to receive ordination. So you know what it's like with all things in this world. It's sometimes easy to think that the struggle is over. We see success. Sometimes we declare victory a little bit too early. What do you see are the remaining challenges for connecting and caring for our global Bhikkhuni Sangha? Because,
Oh, what a great
like I was
question.
saying, with many challenges of recent times, the wider community can easily assume the battle is over. And we're not aware of the ongoing challenges faced by female monastics. And I've got to admit, when I read the suttas, it feels pretty archaic in terms of the treatment of women. And I just began to wonder, times have moved on. And what does female monasticism look like in our current times? What does full emancipation look like?
Sahatu, sahatu, sahatu. I love the question of what does full emancipation look like? And this is so, of course, so brilliant. And this is what's most important to see, even for the Buddha's definition of what it is to have the fourfold community and the level of success that he felt he had seen in establishing his Sangha before he was ready to pass away and enter Parinirvana, final nirvana, included having those who were deeply experienced and knowledgeable in the path, and then also able to refute any wrong views that arise. And so this means those who are Aryas, in this case, means those who are noble ones, those who have entered the Arahant path. And have seen the Dhamma truly for themselves, experienced it, plunged into the stream of the Dhamma, seen Nibbana, touched Nibbana for themselves. And this is enormously important. So to be able to see others who we sense have, say, noble attainments, then that's what answers your question. That's what it looks like. So we know in the Buddha's time that that didn't look the same for everyone. When the Buddha was praising and commending those disciples of his who were Arahants, who he wanted the Sangha to remember as his foremost leading disciples, then he mentioned, and I imagine intentionally, specifically, importantly, remembered them for different qualities. Why is that so important? I feel it's so important because it's so humanizing and it's so realistic, because all of us are quite unique, and what emancipation, what liberation looks like is not just something from a template like a cookie cutter. You see some beautiful Buddhist art, or even like these Dhamma wheels that are here, and it's like the same Dhamma wheel is on each one of the flags, right? But that's not what it looks like in the human way. Yes, there are those characteristics of the Dhamma, and this is representing like the 12, you know, from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, then the Four Noble Truths, and there are three aspects. So yes, that's there, that will be there. But what do they look like? What does that emancipation look like in the physical body? It looks like everybody unique as they are, and the qualities that may be so special and unique in them. If we think about our contemporary masters, then also they're, you know, such a variety. Yeah. And so this is what we need to see, what it's right to see, what we expect to see, and what I believe is truly valuable for us. So it's not all just to look the same, but for us, when we practice with dedication and sincerity, when we practice rightly, then the effects will come from that. And then we see, for these unique karmic circumstances of whoever it is, then we see what emancipation looks like for, you know, those circumstances, and for somebody else, and for somebody else. And this helps to open the way up for the maximum number of people, because when they look around for how that person is expressing themselves or how they're speaking, you know, one is going to feel a connection with one, and one is going to feel a connection with someone else. And even that changes over time as we grow and as we develop. And this is really supportive for the path. So I feel like we shouldn't have a fixed answer. Yes, there are those salient characteristics of the Dhamma in common, but we want to see what it looks like for everybody, unique as they are, as much as possible, to support that. Answering in another way, I'll say personally, internally, being within this process, that it's a great exploration that's unfolding, that we just find out for ourselves. We just see and know for ourselves as we practice, as the path unfolds, as we practice discernment and work with our moral virtue and our ethics and our meditation, and as the wisdom and the insights unfold, you know, the path is then leading inwards or leading onwards in this kind of way. And so then that's the experience of the path unfolding on the individual level, or we see for others who are, like here I'm part of a community, and we have our Dhammadrini Monastery as well as our Aranyabodhi Hermitage, and some of those here I've known for a longer time. And so this is actually one of the really beautiful things that I find, is to see when others also are practicing sincerely with dedication over time, over the years, you know, how the path is unfolding for them. This is actually just such a unique joy in this living way of the Buddha, to be able to see that. Sometimes I ask myself, like, which is more joyful, to see the benefits of the path for oneself or to see the benefits of the path for others? And, you know, sometimes it seems more one, sometimes the other, sometimes equal. They're both really, really valuable and important. And like with the BSWA, as a community, seeing those who are entering in to the community and then how they develop over time, I imagine this to be, you know, likewise, one of the joys and parts of the community there, anywhere that they're well practicing Buddhist communities together. And I think one of the things that can sometimes like cap that joy that I've heard about is when there are glass ceilings in place, like in the places where there's no bhikkhuni ordination. For example, I've heard from some bhikkhus, like, you know, that's it, what that can do to the heart. Or for members of the lay community seeing that and like the heart process, and it's like something like a flower that wants to grow and blossom freely in the garden of the sangha is then getting like, you know, a board put over it or something like that, and you look at that and you feel sad, right? And like, what can you do? And the natural inclination from the good heart is, oh, you want to take that off and let it get some sunshine and nutriment and, you know, then the conditions to be able to grow up and to blossom freely. And if you see that, then you feel glad, you feel happy. Yeah. If somebody says, no, you can't do that because whatever, it's tradition or that kind of thing, then I know for some that can be a cause of sadness, and sometimes even for, you know, such a disappointment or such a heart challenge that it can even be part of their falling away from the path. And the Buddha recognized that in Vinaya, because the basis for all of the Vinaya precepts recognize the things that are like supporting people's faith to grow if they have faith and inspiration. Or those who don't have that, for that to arise and to grow up, and also to like to not do the things that will be cutting off or dampening, you know, that's like putting the board over the growing person, I said flower, but person's inspiration and faith, you know, their path like that. So it's basic principles of Vinaya. So we've learned a lot of letters and numbers of the Vinaya, but it's very important to really also attend to the spirit, the heart spirit of there that the Buddha himself taught and mentioned. That's like underneath it all, like this is the meaning, this is what it's for. It's important to remember that.
Okay, we're recording again.
Okay, so we're back. Question was, this was question number two, is the struggle over? What remaining challenges are there for connecting with and caring for our global bhikkhuni sangha? And I'd say, wow, in the last few decades, if I think about the 30 plus years that I've been in monastic life, then I've just seen these incremental changes over time. And I feel like we have made such enormous progress. We have overcome some of the largest hurdles. And, you know, we're to the point of even having the internationally having the Bhikkhuni Sangha leaders, Mahateris, whether in Thailand or in Sri Lanka or in Vietnam or North America, and now also a growing number of Teris in Australia, which is really, and Europe, a delight. It's so glad to see, and, you know, makes such a big difference. And also, you know, as we saw in this documentary, there are various kinds of struggles that are still present. Some countries don't have a Bhikkhuni Sangha yet. Some states here in the United States, they say, you know, got all these bhikkhunis in California, and can you please come to our state? We'd like to have bhikkhunis here too. We have bhikkhu sangha in almost all or all of the states in the United States, and we have bhikkhuni sangha in maybe only 5 of those states, or less than 10 of the 50. So big growth and progress in terms of things opening up, and in terms of like completely healing and having a whole and cohesive fourfold community that includes bhikkhunis, or manifold community, we have a long ways to go yet. We don't have so many legal hurdles Here in North America, there are no laws that are preventing our ordinations here, and it's not like we become like non-citizens, as they're, struggling with this in Sri Lanka and some issues with this in Thailand as well. We don't have a national office of Buddhism that's regulating things here. And yet also we do experience some of the challenges that those in Asia do to a degree as well. That is, the communities, the Asian Buddhist communities here are much more used to supporting bhikkhus. From the time that people who were born Buddhist were born and they were young kids, then they learned it's valuable and it's virtuous and it's great merit to support the Bhikkhu Sangha. And so some people are able to like turn over their thinking in this regard more quickly, and for others it takes a long time, and for some people it just continues to feel like strange and wrong that like a female body just should not be in the saffron robes, and they say they just feel something like deeply wrong, and it's there in the Buddhist teaching, but it's just because they didn't grow up with it, so it just feels strange, not part of the tradition. But those numbers are in a way I think reducing, because the younger people, as they're growing up, more and more of them are coming into being born into a world in Buddhism where a greatly interconnected world where there are bhikkhunis, and then that is their experience of our world and what's possible in the Buddhist path. So this is rapidly and greatly transforming in Asia. I feel like there are a lot of people that when they get over the hurdle of the idea of thinking of the female form in the patchwork monastic robes and being fully ordained, then it's there in the Buddhist traditions, and there are strong traditions of support. Whereas here in the United States, for those who are like us, then we're a significant number of us here are Westerners, and large number of our supporters are Asian. Also, large number are Westerners, or those who weren't many who weren't born Buddhist, and so then the base of support is not always so readily and easily there in many of the other countries where the Bhikkhuni Sangha is arising. And it's an enormous blessing with the BSWA and in Australia, in Western Australia, that there is the support structure that's been developed by the BSWA as it has. When you're inside it, you experience the benefits of that, and it's like a world unto itself in a way. And that's fantastic. And it's hard to know that what is going on outside in other places is not all like that. It's actually so rare. I've had people write to me and like, where in the world can I go? I know the BSWA, I know Western Australia, but there's a long waiting list. It's like men who want to ordain as bhikkhus, and they want to go to a place where there's also a connected bhikkhuni sangha, where there's a whole fourfold community, and like, where can I go? And I just have to say, that's rare and precious. It's not like that everywhere. There are more and more communities that are starting up, or have this intention, have this motivation, and it's still really rare and precious. So I would suggest as much as possible for those who are compassionate and really wish to support at the broader level, not only the very like local home level, look out for the places, other places where there is such intention, and how to support and nurture and develop that, and where the bhikkhunis are at, and see how to support that and encourage others to do so. So there are so many ways in how we look at things, how we respond to them, how we speak about them to one another, how we share things on social media, even things that lead to disheartenment,
And there are things that really lead to encouragement and to getting the word out and to supporting. And I'd recommend doing that for those who feel the value of this. I'd recommend doing that, however you like to, as much as you can. A little bit or a lot, but use the power that you yourself have for the good in the world that you wish to see. And it really gives us happiness to do that. I find this is one of the bases of happiness and life. And many times things look too big to me. I don't see how to solve the whole thing, but I can see one step at least. I can see one small thing I can do. Even at the community level, we have a community meeting coming up. I don't know how to answer all the questions that are there, but I trust in the process. I'm going to show up. And whatever I can offer, whatever thing I can do to contribute, I will do that. And others who have the heart will do likewise. And it opens up, it works out. It's amazing, amazing process, beautiful part of the jewels of the Sangha, treasures of the Sangha.
Oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That was wonderfully said. Now, this is the question that had a whole lot of interest from our fourfold community. And I think you've answered some of them. And the other, now these are a couple of curly questions. And the first one is, what support do the bhikkhunis need from the bhikkhus to flourish? And equally, what support don't they need?
Wow, that's an interesting question. And I'm imagining that was asked by a very caring and considerate bhikkhu. And so my appreciation to that bhikkhu venerable who asked that question. And I would encourage others listening to ask that question as well. I don't feel like I can give one answer to that, but just to have that heart, to have that mind to ask that question, to think of that question and to ask that question, and then to be willing to listen, and to be responsive, that part is really, really important. Yeah. So blessings to you, venerable, whoever asked this question. And I would encourage those listening, not only bhikkhus, but bhikkhus as well, and those who aspire to be bhikkhus, to think about this and to ask this. I know I've heard from bhikkhus around the world who've listened to my interviews and talks and then contact privately to mention, semi-privately to mention what's important or meaningful, what they're struggling with, their wish to support, and really looking at like how I can do so. And I feel like it's important and valuable to ask the question back to the Bhikkhu Sangha as well. If I think about like one young bhikkhu who I know who wishes to be supportive, and then the struggles that he's experiencing as a member of the Sangha, not with the BSWA in Western Australia, like to be able to work with the situation as it is, to be able to morally, ethically, to be supportive, to not compromise that, and then also not to get into terrible trouble so as to destroy his monastic life or, to come up into conflict with others and like how to work with the things as they are. And, so they're the different sides and aspects to it, even their multiple facets, and it's worth it really to look at all of them and see where are the hindrances and what can we do, what is helpful here. Again, I just want to come back to if there's even one small thing you can do, even if you can't see the whole thing, but you can see one thing or two things that would be helpful, and it's like not be blocked by the enormous vision of the whole thing, but to take those steps ahead, to move forward. And like on the forest trails here, I set out on a trail and I can only see a little bit of it, and I take a few steps and the path ahead opens up before me. I can see the next steps. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah. Okay, another harder question, and these are things we must speak about. So Bhante Sujato recently published the article "The Buddha Would Have Believed You," which looked at looked to the Vinaya for a better way to support women. If female monastics are poorly treated in their sangha, how can we best respond or let our sisters know that we abhor any discrimination or abuse of any kind?
Thank you. I've read a lot of Bhante Sujato's writings, and I haven't read this one, but I can imagine. I can imagine. And I would say there are these things that probably all or most of us are familiar with in terms of like gendered dynamics in our world. And of course, it's different in different countries, different cultures, yet some common patterns are there. And one of those common patterns is that if it's the woman who is the one who is saying something problematic is going on, that she herself is problematized because of that. It's considered that then she's the problem. She's stepping out of line, she's out of place. And then there are the ways that then the perks are given to those who are good. And that is, they don't say. They just try to be nice and go with the things as they are, and not challenge, and not mention the things, because it's out there so much that there are so many benefits. There's a great loss, but that's kind of covered over in this paradigm, in this worldview. But so many benefits to not challenging, not bringing the things up. And what does it mean for her to be problematized? It means that she's seen as not really understanding the Dhamma, or not being in harmony with the Sangha, or she's a little mentally off, or these kinds of things. Even sometimes it's just a subtle gesture, small words. Not saying anything so much like that. And I think to recognize when we see these things, and recognize that often there is something we can say or a gesture that we can make that's not like just going along with that, or not feeling like we ourselves then, to be harmonious, have to like the other person has just made this bad joke about the one who's a problem, and to like just haha laugh together, because that seems like the polite and socially correct thing to do. Is there a kind way, a skillful way, that we can say something different, that we can speak differently, that we can make a different gesture? Just ask ourselves that. And really, it's a training, and it is really about the heart of the Buddhist training, because this is it. This is the karma. This is the samsara. The things come up, and there's the opportunity in all kinds of moments to either go the way that's just like more samsara, and just the way the habits and the way the patterns are, that just go on with these, what is it they call, dysfunctional coping mechanisms, or to take a different turn. and explore that, train ourselves in it. We don't have to get it right the first time. It doesn't have to necessarily work well the first time, but for someone who's practicing, for someone who's training themselves, we know even for our meditation practice, it's like how many tries do you have to try to figure out how is it to be like mindful of the body in a balanced way, or to be able to keep with the breath. And it's so many tries that are like going off one way or going off the other way. We're encouraged to keep with it and keep trying and, given encouragement and moral support. And we do, and then we find, there is the way to do this. But it's a practice, it's a training, it's part of the practice, part of the training, training internally, training externally, our bodies, our speech, our mind. These are the basis of training. It's not wrong in Buddhism to do this. It's right in the Buddhist teaching to do this. And time by time we gain an insight and skill from it, then that's a remarkable witness and example to others. If there were three of us together and one made this bad joke and the other laughed, and then one more does something different to the other two, to the one who laughed because they didn't know what else to do and it was socially uncomfortable, then, oh, here's a different thing. This is a different way. This can be approached and can be done. So it opens things up not just for the one, but for the others as well, as we're such social beings. And we see the path in others so much. We need to work with it ourselves in our own actions, but the example of the others is so important. Sometimes when I think I don't know what to do, I may sit down and just think about the others who I know, who I consider to be like wise and good examples, and just think like, what would they do in this situation? Have I ever seen any good way to relate to this kind of situation that's admirable and seems like leading forward in the path? So often when I give that time to ask that question, I think about it and it comes to mind. I have seen that. There is something that comes up to my knowing then that gives me an example for what I can try. Yeah. So useful. Number two, I would think, is the tendency for women in leadership, particularly in Buddhism. To treat them like tall poppies. And I don't know for North American listeners whether poppies make sense or not, but I know, I heard in Australia, the tall poppy is the one to get chopped, right? Because they're like coming up above the rest of the group. And so, we see this part a lot, and that's something I've been working with getting more senior now as a bhikkhuni, and then also with regards to the other bhikkhunis who are getting more senior. And there's so many things that say, like, to be a good woman, to be humble, to be a good practitioner, then you should be putting yourself down. And it's not appropriate, you shouldn't want to be stepping up in this kind of thing. And all of that is like fine and good. However, however, and it's a big, big however, we understand that it is proper and right in the early Buddhist teaching and the Sangha that we so revere and admire and laud for there to be such leaders. And so, how can we think about putting the others up? And if we think it's all right for a male monastic or a male person to be put up in such a way, just to question ourselves, then if we think that's all right, that's normal, that's fine, then if it doesn't seem equally normal and all right and fine to be doing that for a female monastic or a female Buddhist teacher or leader, then why? And to look at that, to address that, and then what can we do that's moralizing, that's valorizing, that gives moral support to them stepping up, rather than when they do step up, like doing this kind of automatic, very normal social cultural thing to, like, if that person appears female, to cut them down or to doubt them or to make jokes or this kind of thing, right? So I would suggest this, just bringing mindfulness, clear awareness, and then do what is supportive and uplifting. For really for whoever it may be, if they're acting with virtue, if they're dedicated to virtue and to meditation as the Buddha taught, to wisdom and insight, like it's right for us to be upholding, uplifting that. Yeah. And all those who do that.
Thank you for saying all of that, because yes, I agree, the struggle. There is a struggle there. YouTube chat will soon tell you that in terms of tall poppies and women feeling safe, standing up and sharing and being heard. I'd like to jump to the next question now. And I just love the way this was written. So, I've noticed that many women take a long time to arrive at an important life decision, whether it be ordaining or any number of things, applying for a job, whatever. Whereas our male counterparts seem to rush right in. We like to consider our commitments carefully, and we often want them to be profound statements. And do you feel we need to fully experience this lay world, this householder world, before ordaining? To experience the gratification and the danger in order to experience the escape? And in saying that, some statements I've heard, and these all start with but, right? But I need to know what I'm giving up. But I haven't experienced the jhanas. I haven't studied the suttas enough. I don't know if I can identify having achieved any form of Magga-Pala yet. It's as though we need to work our way through the whole Mangala Sutta before we can even consider the option. How do we help our sisters overcome this tangle of hindrances?
Well, we could have an awesome seminar or even a week-long retreat or even a month-long retreat on just this topic, couldn't we? So many of the
We could
questions are like
indeed.
that. Yeah. So I'll just say, I entered monastic life quite young as a teenager, and my life as a young person, it seemed like I had got to experience a lot of things, even as a young person before entering into monastic life. And as a young monastic, actually, it was something important in my whole like formation of the whole things. Like I've already seen a lot of that. I don't feel like I need to do a lot more years of that. Part of it was my own experience, and part of it was seeing others who were near me, and even others who were older than me, like my parents' age. And I absolutely did not feel like I needed to experience that suffering myself before renouncing it. But there was a lot. I just now it's been quite a few years, and I feel like not that I'm wishing to be reborn. I'm not. If I were to have to be, I would actually want to enter monastic life sooner. I feel like there are the things from the time that the aspiration to enter monastic life came up as a younger teenager, and the time that I was able to or did enter monastic life a few years later, at the end of my teenagerhood, there is just so much that I feel like absolutely don't need to do that. And then we live with the effects of these things over time. People feel that they can renounce. But during that period of time, there were so many who were my peers who are no longer alive. And their lives ended during that time because of the behavior that seemed fun or harmless or just like risk-taking was exciting or whatever it might be. And they're not around later on. So hope they have another chance, right? But I could see that. I don't feel like I need to experience dying in all of those ways to gain some kind of understanding or to wish to renounce or to, to not enter into that. So you might say, okay, that sounds like things that are suffering, but those people were trying to have fun, most of them. They were doing things that they thought were fun or exciting. Or, they were also there are those who were doing things that I saw that they thought were boring. But it was the norm. And so they thought maybe sometime in the future, years later, maybe after I've done all this that's expected of me, then I might consider approaching my inspirations and my dreams later on after these things. And I actually, in general, I would not recommend that people have to try everything. Or that you have to give boring years to the norm because it's expected by others and think that you're going to have the opportunity later on. For myself, I feel like I would rather go even earlier, even sooner. There's so much suffering and things that people, even in that category, I include things that people normally think are like joyful. Or happy or fun or exciting or wonderful things that I'm including under this category of suffering right now or dukkha. There is so much. There's just stacked up years of dukkha that I feel like absolutely not necessary to need to go through that. So I would rather just bypass all that, and I feel like I would like to be able to study more and meditate more while I'm younger and healthier more. Not later on, of course, we can enter into the path and we can develop really at any age. I'm seeing friends who are now like older and who are even coming near to death, who are like really developing in the path in amazing and beautiful ways right now. I'm thinking of two friends who are in their transitioning process not far from here. And they're older and they're householders. It is so incredibly beautiful and profound to see how this is for them at this time, with all compassion and appreciation. And I would say, if you have the inspiration, the aspiration, the dedication, don't think that some people say you should get your degree first, or some people say you should experience having a child first, or some people say you should experience having sexual partners first, or some people say you should have a particular level of knowledge or meditation or whatever these things may be. And I guess I just don't really think so. If you have the aspiration and the dedication, go for it and apply yourself as best you can while you have the opportunity to do it, because it's not guaranteed that you will have that much health or that much sanity or that much, even for our inspiration. According to the way we live, our inspiration can be supported and furthered, or our inspiration can really become dull and downtrodden and deadened and even seem like it disappears. It's not a given that we're just going to have it for our whole lives. Our behavior is important. The way we act, the way we live is important. If inspiration is nurtured and supported and we open up and explore it and we develop, that's what feeds the inspiration and the dedication. If we live differently, it's not guaranteed. It's just going to stay and be there. I have seen so many people get looped into, and it's like trapped in the things that they felt like, I just need to experience this. I just need to do this. I just need to get over this. I just, all of these kinds of things. And I see the years going by, and a few, a very few are able to do that. So I would rather recommend that the people not be waiting so much. And I know this gendered aspect, it's cultural, right? It's because the young boys are so encouraged like that so often. And then in some cultures, at least, then that the part about being conservative and being cautious and being the core responsible one, particularly as mothers for women, and you know the role in the family to be like that, it's something that's deeply, there's deep gender enculturation from a young age. So we can see that, but we can also look into it and look through it. I don't think all of us need to be bearing children now. It's just not necessary in terms of humanity at this time. So I know there are a lot of people who are doing so, not because they feel like it's necessarily like their personal calling and it's something they really need to do, but for all kinds of other reasons. And I can add a whole lot of other things to that list, right? So I would recommend nurturing the inspiration, the aspiration, the dedication, going for it, and do what you can while you can do it. There's not a guarantee that you're going to have the chance later. If you're older and you're listening to this, and now is your later chance, also, please do it this time. I'm not saying you're too old for this, your chance is not there, but if you have the inspiration and aspiration and you have the chance in whatever way you're inspired to, please make your best with it while you can.
Oh, thank you. You're speaking to my heart there. Now, as one of these ladies who's found themselves at a certain age and a whole lot of attachments, do you think there'll be opportunities for short-term ordination in the future? 3 months, 3 years? I know in some Asian countries that happens now.
Yes,
What do you think?
actually, in Thailand now, then I think also Indonesia, sometimes in other countries as well, especially in Thailand, there are quite a lot of opportunities, a growing number of opportunities for women who are Thai and also internationals as well to be able to experience temporary ordination. There are temporary ordination programs, and their popularity has increased. They're being offered regularly, and anyone who is inspired to do that, I think I'm glad to see that being offered. Here with Dhammadrini, so far we haven't done that. That is, we haven't specifically offered the temporary ordination programs. However, we're mindful of impermanence, and we offer a lot of different opportunities for people, which are common in many of the Buddhist monasteries around the world. So, for those who wish to come and wear white clothes, white robes, even to keep their hair, but train with the 8 renunciate precepts and live in the monastery together with the monastics, then there's the opportunity to do that. This is often called nekama. And for those who wish to become an anagarika, even with the 8 precepts, to shave off their hair, wear the white robes, live in the monastery together, go on pilgrimage, or even live as a home renunciate or in their own hermitage, in either of these ways, also possible, and I absolutely encourage it. I think what happens when we have Bhikkhuni Sangha available and it's possible to become a Samaneri or a Sikkhamana or a Bhikkhuni, is that things get rebalanced because for those who do wish to then ordain, then go forth with the 10 precepts or to fully ordain as a Bhikkhuni, that's opened up. For those who wish to have some time in the monastery and to experience and live together on a regular basis, or for a few months or a few years even, that possibility is also there and open, not because of the glass ceiling. But because that's what you wish and are inspired to do, that opportunity is there. So I feel like this is very important, that all of these opportunities are opened up. And here, for those who become Anagarikas, if they wish to go forth as a seminary, then they may do so. And to see what that's like, then to train with the renunciation of the 10 precepts in the patchwork saffron brown robes, and to experience that, and then see, does it seem good to go to the next step, the 311 precepts of bhikkhuni ordination? And you know, then the opportunity is open, and it's there for who does wish to do that. I feel like it's really beautiful and proper and wonderful to be able to offer all these opportunities all the time, as many places as we can, and to encourage those who wish as well. Amongst the Buddha's foremost disciples, there were those, both men and women, who chose to live like a monastic life at home, and to live a deeply renunciate life, maybe wearing white and with the 8 precepts, or regularly going to spend the Uposatha or several days a week at the monastery in practice together. So whether they're being a hermit themselves, who is living like, a monastic life, but not as a member of the Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Sangha. You know, they're amongst the disciples, leading disciples of the Buddha, who he praised. This is, it's not a lesser thing. This is something that is valorized and encouraged, and, you know, among our great examples, to be able to do that. So I'll tell you, I've actually been contemplating for what I perceive as like the needs and evolving culture here in the United States, here in North America. I told you we haven't offered temporary ordination programs here. Thailand, Malaysia, Hong Kong, other places in Asia have. But I'm actually considering in the next couple of years inviting some of the senior bhikkhunis who've led such programs in Asia, who we know, to come together and to offer that, one of those programs here. I see those who are like hanging on the fence, as you were talking about, and it's like they have aspiration in their heart, but also they're not going to ordain for their whole life in this lifetime. I know, I can understand, but for them to have the chance to be able to move forward with that aspiration in this lifetime, I feel compassion and appreciation. So I'm considering about that. It is available for whoever wishes to do this. It is available now, in, especially regularly in Malaysia and in Thailand. And we're thinking about doing one here in the next couple of years. Not decided yet. You can get a hold of me if you feel like this is something that would be really great to do. I'll have to debate with our monastics here about it, whether that seems like a good thing or not. But I'm really considering about it. I just feel like I'd like people to be able to go ahead, not to just be stuck, but, you know, move forward. And I know I keep saying this, but like one step at least, even if you can't see the whole thing, just to be able to get unstuck, open up and move ahead. I want to say, wow, what an incredible number of great questions that have been offered here. And I was thinking when I was looking over them, it would be so great to offer a program to be able to ask more bhikkhunis these excellent questions. We have now founded last year, inaugurated last year, the UTBSI, United Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha International. If anyone wants to do something like what Sandra and the BSWA is doing now and asking these questions to me, you could even just take this group of questions that's already gathered and just make a kind of a discussion group amongst our world's leading Theravada bhikkhunis at this time, and like let them talk and give their responses to these great questions. I think it could be fantastic. I mean, this is just imagination. This time now is good. I appreciate it. Blessings to all the great questions, to everyone who watches the documentary and joins for this program for the 2606th anniversary of the fulfillment of the Buddha's fourfold community, his intention to have that, and the founding of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, and the 12th International Bhikkhuni Day. And just sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to the BSWA for being such a bright example. And let's support their coming into being so many more like this, each unique in their own way. To each one of us, as to myself, just taking each of the steps, just one step, one step, one step. We look ahead. We don't have to see the whole thing, but not to be stuck, not to sit on the fence, but to open up our hearts and take the steps ahead. It's truly joyful. And, you know, it's just so full of meaning when we do that. So I want to encourage everybody in this regard, in their own path, in their own way. For those for whom that means to be a bhikkhuni, sadhu to you, all blessings to you. And for those who it means something else, sadhu to you, all blessings to you. For our manifold sangha.
Well, on
Thank
behalf
you,
of the BSWA. On behalf of the BSWA, we sincerely thank you for giving your time. I know you are very busy at the moment preparing preparing for ordinations. And I think I heard you say there is going to be a very special big ordination at Bodh Gaya in November. I read that somewhere. So thank you so much. And maybe we can meet again and cover off on the other questions. But you have given us so much to think about. And I know that our audience, and particularly our female audience, is just going to be so appreciative of these precious jewels. So sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you.
Sadhu Anumodami. Yes, preparing for a bhikkhuni ordination here on this coming, this full moon. November in Bodh Gaya. This will be the first international bhikkhuni ordination organized by UTBSI, the United Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha International. So a lot of those who have been training and preparing for bhikkhuni ordination from around the world, but who couldn't go ahead during the time of COVID, are going to hopefully be able to gather together and at the site of the Buddha's awakening to be able to receive full bhikkhuni ordination there together in November. We hope so. It's a great dream, a great plan. It's moving ahead. Happy thing to do. And may all the conditions be fruitful and auspicious. May we turn our minds in such a way that our thoughts and our words and our actions are so fruitful and auspicious, leading to our happiness and well-being and liberation, emancipation. See, what does emancipation look like in this body?
Oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you.